This is Broad Appeal, Meryl Streep, Bad, Part 2. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, we have been in The New Yorker.
Yes, we have.
And it wasn't even in a cartoon. We were right there in the New Yorker Festival. Steve Bannon didn't make it, but we did.
We did, yeah. All the way from this little flat in Brixton, where the magic happens.
To Broadway.
Yes, to WNYC Studios.
With the imprimatur of Condé Nast.
Yes, thank you, Michael, for part one. That was pretty good, wasn't it?
It's really nice, isn't it, when you have someone on the podcast who actually does research and whose book... As footnotes, who knows all about Meryl instead of us just talking out of our ass.
Well, see, the difference between us and him is that he is accountable for what he says.
That's true. Yeah. That's true, because people actually pay attention to it.
Yeah.
What we need is an army of fact checkers.
Well, you can do that as well. Yeah.
Speaking of facts, our next film is all about uncertainty.
Yeah.
When feelings are facts, or facts are feelings... When faith is on the line, and when ambiguity is the name of the game, what I'm asking is, what do you do when you're not sure? Mm. You know what you do? You play a very broad caricature of a Catholic nun.
Yeah.
We're talking about John Patrick Shanley's Pulitzer Prize-winning play that was made into a film in 2008. The film is called Doubt.
Doubt.
Okay, Shawnee. Now, you mentioned in the last episode that I had really... sold you early on the fact that Sophie's Choice was a bad film. I feel like I also sold you on the fact that Doubt was a bad film, but I feel that maybe this was less of a clear-cut opinion on your case. How did you feel?
Okay, well, the problem with Sophie's Choice is that Meryl cannot make up for what is really an annoying story with annoying people saying stupid things. I mean, what we didn't say in the first half is that when we were watching Sophie's Choice, I think about 10 minutes into it, I turned to you and I said, this is asinine. Do you remember? Yeah. It was an extended, and by God was it extended, sequence of them in a fairground, you know? Like, looking in the mirrors that make you all...
Oh yeah, like,
rolling around in a funnel. Or,
well, it's also because that movie is 2.5 hours long and it literally... Nothing happens until you get to the Holocaust flashbacks.
Yeah. I knew at that point that I was over it, you know?
Well, if I could interject, because I know you're going to give your opinion of Doubt. It's interesting. I would say Sophie's Choice has all the hallmarks of a bad book-to-film adaptation. And Doubt is not from a book, but it's from a play.
Yeah.
And I feel that it probably wears that legacy quite... clearly.
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
You know, it does very much so. I think I've always had issues about plays that are turned into film. However, very often the redeeming quality of that is that you get this, like, snappy dialogue. You get films that are made for actors.
Mm-hmm.
And say what you want about Doubt. You know, it has that distinction of having everyone who gets their name on a single title card getting an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, it's essentially the entire lead cast of the film.
Yeah, it's very, very, very impressive.
I mean, there are other people in the film, but they have nothing to do. It's basically for these four actors.
Yeah, and that ultimately, combined with the good dialogue, saves it for me. It does feel... It has a black box feeling to it.
Well, I have a particular position on this film, and it's influenced by the fact that I saw the play and loved it. It goes without saying, I write plays. I teach playwriting. I think a lot about plays. I also think a lot about nuns and the Catholic Church. My play that's been the most successful of all the plays I've ever done is also about a doctrinaire nun. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Now, granted, it was written 8 to 10 years after John Patrick Shanley wrote his, so maybe I'm just copying him, but she's a very different nun, and it's a very different kind of a play. But Sister Aloysius in Doubt, as she appears on stage, is an extraordinary character. I have frequently extolled to you the virtues of Cherry Jones. I think she is just one of the most phenomenal stage actresses. You had the sad, I think, effect of having seen her in Glass Menagerie here in the West End and being underwhelmed because you've seen too many Glass Menageries and never seem to want to see them again.
Yes, I do not ever want to see The Last Menagerie again.
But
ever.
listen. Cherry Jones is an amazing out lesbian. Do you know who her former girlfriend is?
Sarah Paulson.
She is lesbian royalty.
Yeah.
But Cherry Jones is literally incredible. And as Sister Aloysius, delivering this character to the back row of a theater, she was able to make Sister Aloysius seem witty, funny, intelligent, rounded, emotional, firm in her beliefs, but relatable. It was a tough act to follow for anyone who saw that role. I'm pretty sure that Cherry Jones won the Tony Award.
Mm-hmm.
I actually haven't done my fact-checking. Let's call the New Yorker. And I suppose Meryl is the obvious choice because she has to be this strong, powerful, domineering kind of grande dame. And you would just think Meryl's the powerhouse actress. If it had been me, I would have cast Cherry Jones. I know there would have been no marquee value in that. And Scott Rudin knew what he was doing. And the movie would not have gotten all the Oscar nominations it had if it didn't have Meryl. I don't think. But Cherry Jones, I think if anybody wants to watch her on film brilliantly, go watch Cradle Will Rock, the Tim Robbins movie about the WPA. She plays Hallie Flanagan, whoever it was, the woman who ran the
Miss
WPA. Miss Flanagan. Little girls.
Hannigan.
I know. She's great in that. Enough about Cherry Jones. We're here to talk about the film. We're here to talk about Doubt. Now, you love John Patrick Shanley, am I right?
Well, I love John Patrick Shanley for two reasons. One, he wrote Moonstruck, okay? No, mm-hmm. Three reasons. One, he wrote Moonstruck. Two, the speech he gives at the Oscars for winning Moonstruck.
Which is,
I'd like to thank anybody I ever punched or kissed, and anybody who ever punched or kissed me.
Very mask.
Yeah.
Yeah. For a man who wrote a movie starring Cher.
Yeah, my kind of guy. And thirdly, he seems to have family or his... Where I grew up, there were Shanleys. Mm-hmm. And I think he has family in Mullingar.
Because there's a reference to Mullingar
film. Yeah, but also he wrote a play that was set in Mullingar after Doubt. Did you know this?
I did not.
Yeah, no one cared for it, I believe. Je pense.
Well, I mean, John Patrick Shanley, he is theater royalty. He's written famous plays. He's won an Oscar. He's a good writer. Maybe not everything he's written is great, but I literally think Doubt is great. I think it's really tightly dramaturgically constructed. I remember even seeing it the first time on Broadway. It's one of these plays that you watch it and you think, that scene was extraordinary. Those two characters facing off with each other, that's going to be done in drama schools for years. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think part of what makes it as a play so exciting is that your sympathies kind of keep switching, right? Which is what makes a two-hander or a three-hander or a four-hander so exciting is, like, it's a power battle between this priest who is new and this nun who represents the old guard, but she has suspicions that the priest is maybe involved in sexual molestation of a boy. You kind of keep shifting in terms of what you think may or may not have happened, who to believe, and ultimately, I think at least in the play, you come away from it with a really interesting gray area. And there's all these different ways in which he's constructed it so brilliantly that, like, when the boy's mother comes into the story...
Wow, yeah, like, that's pretty powerful.
But it really kind of throws you for a loop, and it really changes your whole perception about what goes on. And there's all these different, like, series of revelations that I can remember when the play came out, a lot of people were asking, what really did happen? What really did Father Flynn do? But all of those things that seem so effective on the stage, they're maybe not so effective in a film.
Yeah.
Like the father walking out and addressing the audience as if he's talking to a congregation, it can work as a monologue in the theater. Did you think it worked in those repeated kind of sermons that Philip Seymour Hoffman delivers here in this play?
I find in those cases that the reverse shot, the reaction shot, as it were, of people just sitting there in the crowd...
Like raising their eyebrows.
Doesn't really do anything for me, okay? You know, in the theater, in which, of course, you're in the dark.
Yeah.
And he's illuminated on stage. It has a much, much more different effect. The funny thing about Meryl's performance in this is that she... You know, Glenda Jackson said something really interesting a while ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What did she say?
She said, you know, when I moved from theater to film, it was excellent. Because the cameras loved you. Everywhere you went, every turn you take, the camera would be there on you. You didn't need to be aiming for the back row. And the funny thing about Meryl's performance in this is that she's acting like she's on a stage. She's acting for, like, the back pew to the people kneeling down, you know? It's like, Meryl, this is film. this is film acting.
Which is funny because she is considered to be the queen of film acting. Like, yes, yeah. She went to Yale Drama School. She started on the stage. Wendy Wasserstein, blah, 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 Christopher Durang. But, like, at a certain point, she mostly left the stage behind. But this and possibly August Osage County, yes, they're theater adaptations, but they bring out the stagiest nature of Meryl's performance.
Yes, yeah, she's chewing the scenery. And so every so often, I would be kind of blindsided by how good the dialogue was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be like, wasn't that great? And you'd be like, yeah, the dialogue was good, but, you know.
She oversells what are, like, good lines and good jokes, but just say the lines and the jokes, Meryl. Like, you don't need to then underline them to tell us how good the dialogue is.
This is your opinion.
Okay, yeah. So what's your opinion?
Well, for some reason, I kind of thought that, like, you know, her performance in Doubt was this big, baroque, grand, you know. I think in the trailer, there's a scene where she's, like, standing at, like, the window of a church and there's lightning or something. Like,
that was in the movie. No, there's plenty of lightning.
I don't think there was. I think
there's wind and branches. No, there was storms.
Was there? Okay. Yeah.
And flickering lights. That damn light bulb keeps going on and off.
But I mean, like, you know, like, kind of like, you know, you point to the sky and there's a lightning bolt. I think...
possibly.
I think there might be something that was in the trailer that was removed. Like, the trailer is the hammiest part of this whole thing, by the way, I should say. I was really pleasantly surprised to see that it was much more contained than I thought it was going to be.
This past Sunday, what do you think that sermon was about? Sister James? What was Father Flynn's sermon about?
Well, doubt. He was talking about doubt.
Why?
Excuse me, sister?
Well, sermons come from somewhere, don't they? Is Father Flynn in doubt? Is he concerned that someone else is in doubt?
I suppose you'd have to ask him.
No, that would not be appropriate.
I will say, Amy Adams annoyed me in that film.
She has an annoying role.
I didn't care for her.
She has an annoying role. I think, again, I'm sorry if I come across as a pedant and a dramaturg here, but I think, like, in order to understand, if you were constructing this for the screen from scratch, I just don't think you would write any of these scenes this way. Or if you were taking a play and you were a separate screenwriter who was saying, let's take what's good about this play and open it out and adapt it for the screen, I don't think you would end up with this. I mean, the play is these units of dialogue that are mostly two and three people in intensive debates. It's like Sister Aloysius, the Mother Superior, and Sister James, the Innocent Nun, talking about their suspicions and their battles, you know? And that's one big long scene. In the movie, it's like three or four broken up scenes where Meryl says things like, Sister James, walk with me down the hall. And then suddenly they're like having dinner with a bunch of other nuns who don't say anything.
Yeah.
And they're still talking. But literally, if you just took out all those other characters, the other nuns and the lunch lady and the random parishioners.
And the woman with the cat.
The little children. If you took all of them out, like, the dialogue would essentially still be the same because all those other people don't have anything to say.
Yeah, but in its defense, at least they were smart enough to know to do this. Come on, we have seen August Osage County is a terrible example of this, you know?
But August Osage County all takes place in one house. It's much more akin to something like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, where it's this, like, boiling kettle type situation, right? That you put all these people in this one space, right? Mm. This is trying to create this sense of this whole world and this Catholic parish in the Bronx, but none of the other people have weight. And I think the fundamental flaw, and again, it's kind of just set up to fail, in the play, the boy who is the victim of abuse is never seen.
Yeah.
Early on in the film, you see him, you see that he's the one black student in the parish, and it's 1964, and that's obviously, that singles him out in a particular way. But you also watch him, and you read his facial expressions, and you start to, like, make assumptions or guesses about what's true and not true based on how this young, you know, 14, 13-year-old actor is playing the part. You know what I mean? And you watch him interact with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and, like, I want you to try the thought experiment, if you can, of watching the scenes with all that other stuff left out, and how much more powerful it would be when you can literally paint it any way in your head.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Of course I do. Obviously, the scene where Viola Davis turns up is the reveal, the big reveal.
That the boy is black, yeah. Because there's been reference that he's a particular kind of boy and that he stands out in the class up until that point. But until we meet his mother and we learn that he's the first black student, which is well into the script of the play, that's a big, like, revelation, and it kind of upends things. So I'm just saying that, like, in a way, the brilliant dramaturgical construction of the play that works in the theater, I think, works against John Patrick Shanley here. And he's not had enough... Over the summer, I read the oral history of Angels in America, which is anyone who's really interested in that play, that, you know, its legacy in the world or anything to do with the theater, really read that book. It's really readable, even though it's like deep, deep theater.
Who got it for you?
You did. It was your birthday present. Thank you, Sean.
Welcome.
But
пожалуйста.
And in fact, ladies and gentlemen, we did actually read it aloud to each other in bed. Yes, that's right. I read the words of Oscar Eustace lying in bed with Sean. Yeah, that's about as on brand as we could possibly get.
Well, what about Pauline Kael's voice in bed?
We do that
as
well.
We're both nude.
But what I'm saying is, you know, so there's a long section of that oral history where they talk about when Tony was adapting Angels in America for Robert Altman. At that point, he said, I want to make this into a movie. And apparently, if you go to this library somewhere, I don't know where it is, you can see his drafts of the screenplay, which, you know, aren't publicly available for anyone. And they contain all the stuff that's not in the script of Angels. In the theater script, there's like scenes with Belize and Belize's lover uptown. There's like crazy special effects stuff that's thrown in. There's a scene with like Jane Fonda, like with Roy Cohn, like in a taxi cab with Jane Fonda or
Whoa.
Something. Like, I don't know if it's like with Jane Fonda, but like she's referenced. There's like all this stuff that Tony's like, look, if I'm going to make this into a movie, let's make it into a movie. But it got kind of so out of control, and Altman
died.
Was just... No, it wasn't that he died. I think he was just like...
He was overwhelmed.
He was completely unreliable. So they didn't end up making it that way. And then I think Mike Nichols kind of rightly said, you know what, let's stick to something that maybe feels a little bit stagey, a little bit theatrical, but is going to take this work that works so well and just like deliver it quite well onto the screen. For whatever reason, Patrick Shanley, because it's a different kind of play. It's a chamber drama, Doubt, right?
Yeah,
it has four people in it, and one of them is only in one scene. The mother character is only in one scene of the play. The rest of it's just those three people. And that's why you need the Amy Adams character, because if you didn't have someone to bounce...
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
like honey.
She's the audience.
She's honey. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You need to bounce things off of her, because otherwise it's just two people going at each other.
Would you say she's the audience?
Yeah, she has to vacillate between thinking that Sister Aloysius is right and maybe Father Flynn is right, and she needs to go kind of back and forth and lose her innocence over the course of the play.
Yeah, it's about that woman in Alien. What's her name? Lambert Wilson? Is that a woman?
I don't know. It might be. Lanford Wilson?
No, stop it. No, can I just check out?
You can definitely check out.
No,
we all know that to be true.
I need to make a point, okay? No, it's a man. Lambert Wilson is a man. Okay, an Alien cast. Veronica Cartwright, her character was Lambert. Because as you know, in Alien, there's two females. There's Sigourney Weaver's Ellen Ripley, and then there's Veronica Cartwright's Lambert. And Lambert is the one who, like, cries all the time and is scared constantly. And the whole point was that, like, she's how the audience feels.
Yeah.
And I guess, like, that's probably a common trope in... frequent trope.
Well, she's our way in. I mean, in a way, Stingo in Sophie's Choice is like a bit of a version of that. Like, they're more of a device than a character. And Amy Adams does fine with it. You know, it's fine. And Philip Seymour Hoffman does fine, I think. He walks that balance of, like, I'm a progressive man who is actually maybe expressing a lot of the viewpoints that we think are what we would want the church to be. Like, it's got to be humane, it's got to be up with the times, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But also then we start to think, but is he also a pedophile? And like, I mean, I think John Patrick Shanley, I mean, we're both Catholic boys here.
Yeah, like, I was an altar boy.
Yeah, and I was a Eucharistic minister and a lector, and I have relatives who are in the clergy, and we both have a long and complex evolutionary history with our faith and the ideas of the Catholic Church and how it treats sexuality. Do you know what I mean? And, yeah, and like, yeah, the subject matter of this movie is legitimately really interesting. And I think it's interesting that he said it like in this Vatican II time when everything's changing. And it's also so much about gender hierarchies in the church.
Yeah. And so you were a lector.
I was.
That's funny because I was Dr. Lecter. That's not funny, is it?
Dr. Lecter? Dr. Lecter, you put that host down, Dr. Lecter. That may be the body of Christ, but that's the only body you're going to eat, Dr. Lecter.
We can't put that in because it's not funny. But it's funny
sacrilegious. It's funny to me and I'm keeping it in.
No. Take it out.
No, it's staying in there.
Only I can do Jodie Foster.
Didn't do it.
Nope.
It's staying in.
Okay.
Right. The editor has the final say, just like Sister Aloysius.
Okay.
But okay. Okay, we'll get on to talking about Meryl, I'm sure, in a moment.
Yeah, we'll get Michael back.
We'll get Shulman back on the line. But yeah, like, before we do, just talk about, as like a Catholic, how do you respond to the content? The play, when it came out in the early 2000s, was obviously responding to the first wave of abuse revelations. Now we're living through a kind of whole new series of them. Well, how did it feel to be watching it now in terms of the content of what's being said about the church?
Toronto, it's really funny you say that you had one wave of abuse, now we have another one. Well, actually, in Ireland, it's just been a constant wave of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I was concerned, so when I was a kid, there was a couple of scandals. The first one was the technical schools, they were called. So there were schools that were owned by the state. They were kind of like borstels, as it were, which horrors happened, okay? Shortly afterwards, there was the Ferns report, which was about clerical sex abuse in the Diocese of Ferns in particular, as well as stories everyone knew about priests that had either been in school or been in local parishes, that even if they weren't, you know, on prime time, people knew about them. So for me, this is very interesting because obviously you had an uncle who was a priest, who was a really, from what I can tell, wish I met the man, was a very good and dedicated citizen who believed in,
you know, the social gospel, yeah, of social justice.
Which I am 100% behind as an adult, but as a youngster, I was just, this is dogma, this is faith, and this is what you have to do. So I cannot not be on Sister Aloysius' side.
Okay, so what you're saying is you watch this movie and you completely side with her viewpoint.
This is why I actually find her to be a very impressive character. And there were times in this where I was like, wow, Sister Aloysius is the hero of this movie. Triumphant hero. Because she has this great sense of responsibility to do what is right.
Yeah, she says, like, my role is to be as clever as the fox.
Yeah. And that, for me, is just incredible. Because here is this woman who, and women in the church, we always know, we're forced into a structurally inferior position, doing all she can to bring justice that will not be done any other way. And even though Meryl might ham it up on occasion, I think her character is phenomenal.
Look, I think we have to separate three different things, right? We have to separate real life, the character of Sister Aloysius, and the performance of Meryl Streep.
Okay.
Real life, the structural misogyny and anti-woman construction of the entire church hierarchy is horrible. And, I mean, no one loves nuns more than I do. Now, this is honestly true, right? Like, I've written whole plays about the incredible feminism and power of the sisterhood. And in addition to my uncle being an amazing priest, my aunt, his sister, was an amazing nun. And, like, I have absolute unerring faith in the sisterhood, and frankly, if they were running things in the church,
none of this ever would have happened.
Well, none of this would have happened, and also I think the church would be far more focused on some of the things that it's becoming more focused now under Pope Francis, which is aiding the poor and the true spirit of Christ and people like Saint Francis and Saint Clare. So let's just say all of that to be true.
Yeah.
But in this construction of these two characters, Father Flynn and Sister Aloysius, Sister Aloysius, you're right, she is an amazing character because she has had this experience. She obviously knows the power and the potential abuse of power that men in the church have. And you get this sense that she is aware of things that have gone on that she and other sisters have had to intervene, even though they're not technically able to fully intervene. And that's very strong and that's very powerful. But she's also a person who rules the school with an iron fist. And Meryl really plays this up, right? Like, her first entrance is like, you don't even see her face, and she's just walking down the aisle with you, slapping children and whipping them and telling them if they write with ballpoint pens, they'll press down and their handwriting looks like monkeys. You know what I mean? Like, I think we're meant to see her as, in many ways, stuck in the past, incredibly dogmatic, not progressive. And Father Flynn is someone who connects to people in a more human way, who acknowledges doubts, who acknowledges crises of faith, who, other than the fact that she seems to suspect him of this behavior, actually seems like a good parish priest who's trying to, like, connect with his parishioners and turn things around, you know? Yeah. And in, like, a 1964 context, is trying to be the hip priest who's down with the people, right?
Yeah.
So he's not like the bishops in Spotlight. Because to me, the ambiguity is, I think that Father Flynn is probably a gay man who has entered the priesthood to kind of escape from his own sense of his sexuality. Something has happened in his previous parish. We don't know if that is abuse. We don't know if that's same-sex attraction to, like, another seminarian or what it might be. And I think it's pretty clear that the boy Donald Miller, who she suspects him of being involved with, is also a young gay boy and a young gay black boy, and that they do have a bond, they do have a connection, and he has singled him out for special favoritism and treatment, but that may not be actually having boarded into anything like sex. In this culture that is also, it's, yes, it's about disempowering women, but it's also about disempowering non-conformist same-sex desire.
It might be about that.
Well, the church is definitely about that. And this, I think that, to me, that's one of the threads in the play that I see.
Okay, yeah, you see. Okay, but I have such doubts.
The one thing that I have no doubt about is the person who really walks away with this entire movie.
Well, that's Viola Davis, obviously.
Do you agree with me?
Oh, of course, yeah.
But why, of course?
Here's the thing, actually. I kind of thought I knew what her performance was. Crying mother traumatized by events revealed to her.
Which is like Fences, sort of, really.
Yeah. This would have been a better win than Fences.
If she had to win supporting, which she did.
Which she did.
Let's just hope Widows allows her to be a fucking badass.
You know, her husband has come out and said that he thinks Widows is going to be an absolute game changer in her career.
I fucking hope so.
I think it looks great.
I mean, at least she's... It's not set in the 60s, is it? Please don't let
it
be
set right now.
Okay, because the original series is sometime in the 70s or something.
It looks very au courant.
Because, like, literally everything that Viola Davis ever gets any recognition for, she's playing, like, a woman who, like, cleans houses in the 60s or 50s. Like, so just the poor woman, like, cannot wear an apron anymore.
How about cleaning houses in the future?
That's called Solaris. Anyway, but do you know what I mean? Like, she talk about a crazy rounded character. Like, she is not just another long-suffering black mother. She is someone who comes and isn't sure why this nun has called her in to talk about her boy. He's been kicked off the altar service. And she is negotiating a very complex role in that scene with Meryl. And she just has this wellspring of emotion that I don't even think Meryl can match. Like,
but she's totally very different.
She's concerned for her boy. She's troubled. She's walking this fine line. She's kind of challenging the white woman who's a representative of the church and who holds her family and the boy in a kind of power and privilege, but she kind of stands up to her. She recognizes, I think, her boy's queer truth.
Yeah.
Like, she says, this is the boy's nature and he just has to get through till June. Mm-hmm. And if this man has noticed that in my son, then if he looks out for him, maybe it's not a bad thing. And, like, Meryl is shocked, or Sister Aloysius is shocked, but I also think Meryl is shocked, because Meryl is like, fuck, I've not acted this well in 20 years. No, I mean...
I haven't danced in 40 years.
Do you know what I wrote in my notes during that scene? Because, like, Viola is, like, channeling all this emotion, and I wrote, Meryl Streep, flustering and fidgety, acting like Shirley MacLaine.
Oh, that is low. That is a low blow, Mullen.
She doesn't quite know what to do in the space of this force of what Viola Davis is delivering.
I believe this man is creating, or may have already brought about, an improper relationship with your son.
I don't know.
I know. I am right.
Why you gotta know something like that for sure when you don't?
What kind of mother are you?
Excuse me, but you don't know enough about life to say a thing like that, sister.
I know enough.
You know the rules, maybe, but that don't cover it.
I know what I won't accept.
You accept what you gotta accept and you work with it.
This man is in my school.
Well, he's gotta be somewhere. Maybe he's doing some good, too.
After the boys.
Well, maybe some of them boys wanna get caught.
I don't believe it has anything like 1 ounce of the weight of what Viola Davis delivers, like the complexity of that emotion.
You think this is a kind of a Luna, whatever her character's name, and what's her name? Irina Starla. What's her character's name in Terms of Endearment? Viviana. What is it?
Aurora.
Aurora. Okay, you see where
Aurora Borealis. No. Aurora Greenway.
Oh, God. Oh, God almighty.
Well, yeah, I know you hate Terms of Endearment, but like, I mean,
film.
Shirley MacLaine is perfect as the, like, self-serving, like, hammy mother in Postcards from the Edge. But, like, Meryl has descended into that hammy camp. She's in, like, a nun drag. She's, like, covered in her fucking wimple. So, therefore, she has to only act with these eyes that are, like, bulging out of her face.
Hey, you know, she transforms. Give her that.
She plays Sister Aloysius like a panto dame.
That's unfair. I think we need a tiebreaker on this. Let's get Shulman back in.
Yeah, okay. We'll call Michael, and he'd better agree with me, or he's getting excommunicated.
Yeah. I don't think that's going to be a problem.
What happened in the rectory?
Happened? Nothing happened. I had a talk with a boy.
What about?
Private matter.
He's 12 years old. What could be private?
Should I get the...
No.
I object to your tone.
This is not about my tone. Or your tone, Father Flynn. It's about arriving at the truth.
Brian, let's welcome back Michael. He's returned to help us out, to break a tie.
Yeah, he's gonna relieve us of all our doubts.
Michael?
I'm ready.
I am very firmly on the side of Cherry Jones. I'm very firmly on the side of Father Flynn, and I just think that Meryl Streep took the character of Sister Aloysius, which I think is a brilliant character in contemporary drama, and she turned it into pure ham. It's an Easter ham full of googly eyes and a Bronx accent that's thicker than an egg cream. Sean feels somewhat differently. He actually had a lot of sympathy for Sister Aloysius and just, like, felt that she was right on target.
Well, you know me, Brian, I'm always dazzled by the magic of theatre, and I think it has residual traces on film. I cannot be brainwashed. You cannot gaslight me on this one, okay? I kind of liked it. And the times where you would point out that she was having it up, I would have to be like, really? Is she?
She's underlining every line with perfect Catholic school penmanship. Okay, Michael, you have to break this tie.
I might surprise you guys. I'm with Brian on this one.
Yes!
You know, we talked about with Sophie's Choice how she's often the best thing in a movie that isn't as good as her. I think it's the opposite. I think this is actually a movie where she's a bad thing in a good movie. And I actually think her performance... Okay, first of all, this didn't have to be an accent job. Like, no one else is doing this honking accent. Like, she didn't have to go full accent, you know. She did not, you know, I feel like this is a performance where her beloved makeup artist and hairstylist, J. Roy Helen, might have also, like, gone a little far. Like, I feel like she's giving a performance that would make sense in a different kind of movie, but this play in this movie all has to do with this kind of psychological tug of war and who you believe and who you don't believe moment to moment. And she is just like this honking, you know, harridan who is just ramming through the movie. Whereas I think Amy Adams and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Viola Davis are all kind of very carefully modulating their performances, trying to make these people very real. And I really think she's such a caricature in it, and to me it kind of ruins the point of the movie, because, I mean, I didn't see the play, unfortunately, but I imagine that what you're supposed to be thinking during this play is, who do I believe? Am I on team sister, or am I on team Flynn? And that you're supposed to be wrestling with yourself and confronting your own doubts. The way the movie plays out because Aloysius is so inherently kind of annoying and comes off as so sort of stubborn and, you know, tyrannical almost, you're just never siding with her. And then Philip Seymour Hoffman is just this, like, really super charming guy who you really want to believe. Now, as we know from all of the events in the Catholic Church since then, like, statistically, probably he's guilty. But watching this movie, you kind of think, well, it's really a movie about persecution and, you know, false accusation. And it almost turns into, like, The Crucible, where it's about, you know, a witch hunt, rather than, I think, what it should be about, which is the uncertainty of knowing the truth. There's just not enough balance, because Philip Seymour Hoffman is someone who we like so much that we don't want to think he's guilty, and Meryl Streep is someone who's so irritating that we don't want her to be right, because she clearly has delusions of grandeur and this sort of, like, is clinging to authority. If that had been more balanced off, and if we had been allowed moments where we really thought, oh, wow, maybe she's totally right, then it would have been a much more effective movie, and I think much more ambiguous.
Are you ready to confess your guilt, Sean?
Well, I don't know. Well, we talked about the issues of the movie, and we both talked about that we come from very different aspects of it. Even though Sister Aloysius, like, you know, you say, is like, she has these quite delusions, and that she is this kind of moral authority for everything, you know what I mean? Like, she's a moral authority for behavior of children, for penmanship, and for clerical sex abuse. I kind of just wanted to believe her all the time. And I, at the end of it, I still do.
She plays it like God. Like, I literally think she plays Sister Aloysius as if she thinks she's God. But I also think Meryl plays it as if Meryl thinks she's the god of acting.
That is really shady.
I'm being deliberately provocative. But, like, Michael, one of the things we said is, like, it's really palpable in the Viola Davis scene. Because, obviously, this was Viola Davis's big breakthrough role. And she'd had small roles in a number of other things. But, like, to give her this big central performance here, you're suddenly like, oh, my God, this woman is delivering such intense emotion and multi-layered emotion, which I have a vivid memory of Cherry Jones doing on stage. Now, granted, maybe Cherry Jones's performance was equally broad, but she was delivering it to the back row of the theater. Meryl doesn't need to do that when John Patrick Shanley has his camera, like, right in her face, you know? She's pulling out all the stops every single time until that last line reading, oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, well, I do love the ending. I have doubts! I also love the line, the wind is very peripatetic this year. I could have done with a little less wind imagery. I kind of got it after the first three, like, wind shots. You know, it kind of, this movie reminded me a little bit of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because I just recently wrote a piece for Vanity Fair about Nurse Ratched, and I interviewed Louise Fletcher, who I think is so brilliant in that movie. And that's another movie where the deck is kind of stacked, and it's all about this push and pull, this tug of war between two characters. And what she did is, if she had played Nurse Ratched in the way that Meryl plays Aloysius, you would have just, there would have been no kind of ambiguity and chemistry in that movie. But the fact that she really held it all in and kind of had this blank face, it made her scarier, it made her more convincing as an authority, and it made her more sort of, I don't know, mysterious and interesting. I think Meryl does do that in a lot of movies. For instance, Kramer versus Kramer, where she was sort of, her character was drawn as a kind of flaky, you know, basket case, and she found this real grounding to that character and really shifted the balance of Ted versus Joanna Kramer. And I wish that she had done that here, but I think that she just lards it on too much.
I also think Devil Wears Prada, to me, is the great example of that, which is just a few years before this, because, like, literally the title of that film indicates that Miranda Priestley is the devil. And if there's any role that, like, would call for a sort of broad authoritarianism, you would think it would be Miranda Priestley. And we can only imagine, like, what Glenn Close or Angelica Houston would have done. But Meryl trusts that actually, if she plays it at a soft register of authority and she gives Miranda Priestley, like, depth and, you know, layers that get revealed, that it's actually going to be funnier, it's going to be truer, it's going to be realer. And, like, Miranda Priestly is, to my mind, one of the greatest roles that Meryl's ever played. And, like, Sister Aloysius, I would have much rather seen just any redoubtable character actress in this role. Like, Kathy Bates should have played this role.
Yeah. So Brian and I had talked about the fact that Meryl has rarely, in the many films she has done, ever played characters who are living. Even though, obviously, Miranda Priestly is a fictional character, she's based on a living character. And, of course, I don't think Anna Wintour is the type of person who needs to raise her voice. So, I don't know, maybe when Meryl feels that she has to live up to some standard, of which a living person can kind of, you know, make their voice heard about it, she might actually, you know, take it in a different direction. Because I was watching clips of Adaptation the other night, and I just thought to myself, this is the film, aside from The Devil Wears Prada, this is the film that she deserved her 2000s Oscar for.
Mm.
I actually think Adaptation is why she is what started her comeback phase, because, you know, the 90s were a weird period for her, and she was kind of stuck going from thing to thing, not really having her footing in, as an actor, as a movie star anymore. And Adaptation, when she won the Golden Globe for that, she is so shocked. She gets up and she says, well, I was just settling in for a long winter's nap. I haven't won anything since the Pleistocene era. And the whole narrative of, you know, Meryl Streep, greatest living actress, who is currently in her 50s and 60s, ruling Hollywood, I think it started with Adaptation because she was kind of liberated to do something super weird that no one would ever think she would do. And that, I think, and so this movie, Doubt, it's kind of a few years into that. Let's see, it's, you know, it's before Julie and Julia, it's after Mamma Mia. It kind of builds and builds, and I guess climaxes on an artistic level, I think, with The Devil Wears Prada, and on a career level with The Iron Lady and winning another Oscar. But this is kind of on the incline. And I know that you guys have talked about this on the podcast before, but I do think some of the movies in this period, she's acting in a style that's out of step with the style of the movie. You know, one of them is August of Osage County, also didn't need to be an accent job, but it's another thing that's a play, but something where she's acting in a register that's a little bit louder, that's bigger and louder than the people around her. I actually think it makes sense in something like The Iron Lady, because she's playing someone who is sort of a historical figure who's thought of as over the top and
who's, you know, a performer, yeah, right? She's, yeah, like, she was, yeah. She's finding how to perform female authority, mm-hmm, in The Iron Lady. Mm-hmm.
She's a public figure who's performing. There's an element of kind of camp to it. I'm not saying it's a good movie, but I think it's a performance style that makes sense for that movie. Whereas in Doubt and in August Osage County, I wish that the director had scaled her back. And I think that when she works with weaker directors, that can happen. And it's interesting that the director of Doubt is John Patrick Shanley, who I don't think has directed another movie. He's written great stuff like Moonstruck, but I suspect that he might have been sort of steamrolled by her.
You have no right to step outside the church!
I will step outside the church! If that's what needs to be done, though the door should shut behind me, I will do what needs to be done! Though I'm damned to hell! You should understand that. Or you will mistake me.
Let's all hope that Andrea Arnold can rein her in Big God. Little Lies Part 2.
Now, that is very interesting. That's for a different podcast.
For another day.
Yeah, after we've watched the first season.
I'm so glad this movie exists, though, because one of my favorite Meryl acceptance speeches is the SAG Award for Doubt. Can I just say, there is no such thing as the best actress. There's no such thing as the greatest living actress. I'm in a position where I have secret information, you know, and I know this to be true. And then she gives a great shout out to Viola Davis, where she says, my God, someone give her a movie. And like, it's just a great speech where she just kind of completely didn't think she would win. And she kind of doesn't care. And she says whatever the hell she wants. Oh, to the Sisters of Charity, Sister Peggy, your love and your work is so inspiring. What's so inspiring to all of us? All right, I got to get off.
Wasn't that the same season where she and Sandra Bullock made out on the red carpet as well?
No, it was at the award stage of the Independent Spirit or something.
Okay.
I watched it the other night.
Like, I know Sandra Bullock gets a lot of flack for not deserving that win, but, like, she certainly deserved it more than Meryl that year.
You know, listen, this is not... We're not going to go into a conversation with The Blind Side now, okay? Although, that's a very strange... That whole narrative is its own episode.
That's another day.
Yeah. Well, when you guys do your Sandra Bullock season, I look forward to that.
Oh, God, remember her in Crash? I've just had a flashback. Ooh, Michael, listen, we're going to cleanse our palate of that. We might need to call on your authority at least one more time, though. So, you know, don't put any cakes in the oven or anything like that.
Thanks, Michael.
All right.
Oh. Sister James.
What is it, sister?
I have doubts. I have such doubts.
All right, Sean, so what do you think? Michael made a lot of good points there, and mostly they were good because he agreed with me.
Mm-hmm.
Have the two of us ganging up on you convinced you that you were wrong?
I'm thinking about something Michael said earlier, in which he thinks that in the case of doubt, that Meryl is a bad thing in a good movie. And I'm a little bit more toward that leaning this time. Because, you know... I think, as we said before, it's very difficult to make a film of a play. John Patrick Shanley is not a film director, but he did a good job. I will acquiesce slightly to your opinions. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that the ex cathedra rule of New Yorker infallibility has reigned supreme yet again. Ladies and gentlemen, there is one more... episode in this Bad, Badder, and Baddest series of Meryl Streep. It will also feature interventions from Michael Shulman. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Broad Appeal Pod. Brian is at B.A. Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X. Michael is at M.J. Shulman. And don't forget to leave us a rating or review on iTunes.
And we will see you soon for some devilish good fun as we conclude this series.
All right, see ya.